Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. The talk was going to be introduced by Dick Walcott, but unfortunately he's got caught in Canberra with President Obama's visit, so I'll read out his introductory comments. Philip Flood makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the launch of his book, Dancing with Warriors, a diplomatic memoir. And there are copies of the book on sale tonight, but I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. Philip Flood is the only person to have headed the Department of Foreign Affairs, the Office of National Assessments, and Australia's Agency for International Development. Among diplomatic positions he has held are Australian High Commissioner to the United Kingdom, Ambassador to Indonesia, High Commissioner to Bangladesh, and Minister in the United States. He has headed several public inquiries for government, including the inquiry into the Australian intelligence agencies that followed the start of the Iraq War, an inquiry into immigration detention centres, and an inquiry relating to pharmaceutical trade between Australia and the United States. Now, Philip Flood will speak about his book very shortly. In the meantime, I will read Richard Walcott's comments in launching the book. I am very sorry, I am very sorry that I am in Canberra this evening and unable to participate in what I believe will be an interesting event and discussion to which I've been looking forward. In the first notice that the Institute sent out, Philip's book was described as Dancing with Wolves instead of Dancing with Warriors. If my memory serves me correctly, this was the title of a Kevin Costner film. I'm reminded of that confronting New Zealand film, Once Were Warriors. Some of our political leaders who fight political battles for good causes can be described as warriors, but others whose policies lead to deaths and widespread suffering might be, in fact, better described as wolves. Some other political figures remind me less of warriors or wolves and more of the nervous and self-protecting knight Rodney in the often amusing Wizard of Oz comic strip. And Dick Walcott continues. Sadly, I think the culture of conformity, which I believe has grown up in public service in the first decade of this century, during which the number of conviction politicians declined under the growing influence of polls, focus groups, and a response to popularism. The purpose of good government should be much more than acting to stay in office. Philip Flood and I both had the privilege of serving as secretaries of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade at very active and demanding but different periods. I, Dick Walcott, occupied the position from 1988 to 1992. Philip became secretary in March 1996, 4 years after I had retired. My time as secretary was served under the Hawke and briefly the Keating government. Except for a few days with Bill Hayden, Gareth Evans was foreign minister throughout my time. Conversely, Philip was secretary under the Howard government with Alexander Downer as his foreign minister for all of his secretaryship. And Dick Walcott continues, we were both therefore involved in major historical events, and I'm sorry we are not able to discuss them with the audience tonight. Philip was posted in two Asian countries, in the United States, three countries in Europe and the UK, despite the fact that he describes in the book he had confessed to Howard that he was a Republican. Conversely, I served in four Southeast Asian posts, the United Nations for 6 years, two African countries, and in one European country, twice, if you count the former Soviet Union as part of Europe. The major post in which we both shared service was Indonesia, one of Australia's four most important bilateral posts, some 15 years apart. We both faced considerable difficulties. And Dick Walcott continues, I was in Jakarta when the five journalists working for Australian media were killed in Belibo in October 1975 and when Indonesia invaded East Timor in December 1975. Philip was in Jakarta when the Santa Cruz massacre occurred in November 1991. I was with Foreign Minister Gareth Evans in Seoul at the third APEC ministerial meeting at the time. Indonesian Foreign Minister Eli Elatas was there too, and it was Gareth Evans and I who, having first received the news reports about Santa Cruz, informed Eli Elatas about it. Philip was secretary during the military intervention in East Timor. Philip was also in Jakarta for Prime Minister Keating's visit to Indonesia in April 1992. What, perhaps, he may not have known was that I had briefed Keating that Indonesia should be one of the first countries he should visit as Prime Minister. Keating had wanted me to accompany him on his visit, but I said this would cause difficulties as I had only recently retired and we had a competent ambassador in Jakarta. And Dick Walcott continues, although I had retired, I was asked by both Howard and Foreign Minister Downer to carry out special envoy missions in March-April 1996. Philip was secretary at the time. The then Prime Minister of Malaysia, Dr. Mahathir, had announced that he was visiting New Zealand, but Australia was not included. I was asked by Howard to visit Kuala Lumpur to see if Mahathir could be persuaded to include Australia now that there was a new government in Canberra. This was done. Alexander Downer also asked me to visit Jakarta and urged President Suharto to receive him when he visited Jakarta in order to pave the way for an early visit by Howard. Downer was concerned because of our relations with Indonesia had drifted somewhat and Suharto had declined to receive Gareth Evans on his last visit, as Philip describes in his book. This was also arranged. Dick Walcott concludes, I was appointed to the Advisory Council which produced the first white paper on foreign and trade policy, which Philip describes in his book. Despite these events, I fell out with both Howard and with Downer, when after much thought I opposed publicly our involvement in the destructive and, in my view, unnecessary war against Iraq before the conflict in Afghanistan had been properly resolved. This, of course, was one issue on which Philip and I would disagree, and Dick Walcott concludes, there are other issues too. For example, we had some different views on the lead to the intervention in East Timor, which I set out in my book, The Hot Seat, Reflections on Diplomacy from Stalin's Death to the Bali Bombing. I also had a problem with Philip's endorsement of the Howard Doctrine that Australia does not have to choose between its history and its geography. At best, this is questionable. Our history is a past reality, some aspects of which are inspirational, others are reprehensible. Our history also leads to a number in the community psychologically to hanker after a bygone past. Our geography is, in fact, a geographical reality, and this is where our future lies. I had hoped to discuss this important issue tonight, but alas, I am in Canberra. And so I conclude on behalf of Dick Walcott. I could go on, but it would not be appropriate to do so. To conclude, Philip's book, published by Australian Scholarly Publications, is indeed a detailed, well-researched and important contribution to what will be an ongoing debate about foreign policy in the 1990s and in the first few years of this century, especially the Howard years as a background to the great changes in the Asia-Pacific region and global power balances which we will face as this decade unfolds. So those are Dick Walcott's launching comments, and I now ask Philip Flood to talk about dancing with warriors, but dancing with wolves if you like. Okay. What's that? No, I think we're right. Okay.
Thanks very much, Darren, and it's a pleasure to have this opportunity to talk about my book, Dancing with Warriors, at the Institute. The Institute brings stimulus, insights, and fresh ideas to a vast audience, and I'm delighted to pay tribute to the outstanding contribution that Anne and Gerard make to the intellectual life of Australia. I'm delighted to see here a former colleague, Rawdon Dalrymple, himself a very distinguished diplomat, another diplomat who actually started as a politician but transformed himself into a successful diplomat, Michael Boehm from New York, and also a former colleague from university days. We worked very closely together, Don Gibson, here with his wife. And I'm grateful for the generous comments of Dick Walcott, who has made a distinguished contribution to Australian diplomacy. Sir William Dean, the former Governor General, said he thought when he heard the title was Dancing with Warriors, he thought too that I was subconsciously thinking of Dancing with Wolves, but that I knew that Kevin Costner had appropriated this in a film and in a book, and therefore I settled on Warriors. But that's not correct. I think those who fight the political battles deserve the accolade Warriors, some more than others, and I'm very happy to stick with that term. I'm grateful to Nick Walker, the director of Australian Scholarly Publishing, for his support, and also the distinguished editor Dana Rowan. And of course I have a special debt to my wife Carol, who shared the journey of this book. Diplomats like to tell the story of the foreign minister who had too much to drink at a diplomatic reception in Lima in Peru. When the music began, the foreign minister saw a beautiful woman in purple on the other side of the room. He crossed the floor and invited her to waltz. The minister was taken aback when the personage in purple refused his invitation, and he boldly asked why. He was promptly told, "Firstly, you're drunk. Secondly, this is not a waltz, but the Peruvian national anthem. And thirdly, I happen to be the apostolic nuncio to Peru." This story is based on fact. The minister was Britain's foreign secretary, George Brown. A broader point of the story is that ministers have choices. When I joined the Foreign Service, Australian foreign policy was, to a significant extent, dominated by our relations with Britain and with the United States. We had links with Asia, but they were relatively modest. Women were second-class citizens, Indigenous Australians were treated as social outcasts, religious divisions permeated social life, and alas, the White Australia policy held sway. Now, half a century later, many of the restrictions and divisions in our society have been vigorously addressed. And over this same period, our foreign and trade policy has come of age. For some time, we've been a player in our own right. After he came here in 1836, Charles Darwin wrote that Australia, doubtless, someday will reign a great princess in the South. But he felt that Australia was, for the moment, too great and too ambitious for affection, yet not great enough for respect. We may not yet be the great princess in the South, but international respect for the quality of Australia's achievements, including our role in international affairs, has unquestionably increased. From the mid-20th century to the early 21st century, Australia's stature in the world has been enhanced both by the successful management of our economy and by the quality of our defence, foreign and trade policies. Australia is regarded as a more significant and a more significant, substantial country than it was 60 years ago. And over this time, I've been fortunate to work for 9 prime ministers and closely with 5 of them, with Whitlam, Fraser, Hawke, Keating and Howard, and of course with many foreign and trade ministers. And the conclusion of my book is that our leaders, the warriors of government, have done well in advancing Australia's security, in building stronger and more diverse relations with the rest of the world, and in creating the envious situation, or if you prefer, the relatively envious situation, Australia enjoys today. Our political leaders have done particularly well in building substantial relations, and at this point I mean government-to-government relations and commercial relations, with the major countries of Asia, with China, Japan, Korea, Indonesia, and to a lesser extent India. Today we benefit from an extraordinary relationship with China. It seems hard to remember that until 1972, our formal position was that China did not exist, or more strictly, that Taiwan was the government of all China. All prime ministers, from Whitlam to Howard and since, have been focused on China. China is our biggest trading partner, taking a quarter of all exports. Australian governments have had to take the lead since in China, the Chinese government takes the running in just about every core activity. Howard gave special attention to expanding the trade and investment relationship with China, and he deserves credit for taking a significantly different policy to the United States. Howard emphatically concluded Australia could both develop a substantial economic relationship with China without diverting in any way from our strong alliance with the United States. Indeed, he strengthened the alliance. But it was Whitlam who started the process of change. As a relatively young officer, in 1973, I was asked to join the party of the first Australian Prime Minister to visit China. As was his custom, Whitlam took with him a very large official party. I was the youngest and the junior in a strong team. We knew the Prime Minister would be welcomed warmly, but no one was prepared for the breathtaking reception at Beijing Airport. More than 10,000 brightly dressed schoolchildren waved coloured flags and ribbons and chanted a welcome as the large party emerged from the plane. Thousands of people, smiling and waving, lined the streets as we drove into Beijing. The Chinese leadership wanted to make a spectacular gesture of approval to mark the first official visit to China by an Australian head of government. The carnival atmosphere was grandly celebratory, but totally unreal. At the time, China was still substantially closed, with the Cultural Revolution still running its course. The Chinese economy was in a total mess, and Mao's great leap forward had fallen flat on its face. Yet here was an ailing communist state pulling out all stops for the leader of what it surely knew was a broadly conservative capitalist country. My role was modest, helping negotiate wheat and sugar deals and helping Dick Woolcott negotiate the press communique. Every member of the party met the remarkably clever Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai. The man who had asked what he thought of the French Revolution replied, "It's still too early to tell." Whitlam insisted on meeting the frail Chairman Mao on his own. As his foreign affairs advisers, Dick Woolcott and I were excluded from the meeting, and we were obliged to stay in the VIP bungalow while Whitlam went off to meet Chairman Mao. After the meeting, we asked the Prime Minister how he found Chairman Mao. "Comrades," Whitlam remarked, and that's the way he always referred to us. I asked Mao what would have happened if instead of President Kennedy, President Khrushchev had been assassinated. Whitlam said that Chairman Mao reflected, and then he replied, "Prime Minister, one thing is certain, Aristotle and Assis would not have married Mrs. Khrushchev." Dick very quickly said, "You made that up, Prime Minister." It was some time, indeed it was about 2 or 3 years, before Whitlam admitted that he had. Mao was senile and barely coherent. Leaving aside his humour, Whitlam's visit was most valuable in restoring balance to our foreign policy. The visit put a ceremonial seal at the end of the previous fiction, whereby the government in Taipei was regarded as the government of all of China. Whitlam did not know this, but the United States moved at around the same time to recognise communist China. For Australia, it was the beginning of a remarkable change. Japan's another instance where our political leaders have been ahead of public opinion. A very important development before I came to government was the bilateral trade agreement forged by John McEwen. When he was Prime Minister, Howard surprised many Australians when he said, I believe correctly, that Japan is Australia's closest friend in Asia. Japan is the Asian country most likely to support Australian political and strategic initiatives. I was fortunate to work closely with Gareth Evans in changing Australia's relationship with Indonesia, and his work was carried on by Alexander Downer. Their work enjoyed the strong backing of Hawke, Keating and Howard. Dick Woolcott and I agree on most aspects of Australian policy towards Indonesia, but as noted in your comments, we don't agree on the issue of Prime Minister Howard's handling of East Timor in 1998 and 1999. In my view, Howard deserves high credit for his handling of this matter. He seized an opportunity which led to the people of the province being able to decide their own future. After the departure of Suharto as president in 1998, his successor Habibie was more open to ideas about East Timor. Howard wrote to Habibie, encouraging Indonesia to think about an act of self-determination for East Timor at some future time. Howard's been criticised, wrongly in my view, because Habibie went far beyond Howard's proposal and decided to have a referendum nearly immediately. The referendum, organised by the UN, in that referendum, Indonesia's preferred outcome was rejected by 78.5% of the vote. Disappointed with the outcome, Indonesia's military behaved as vengeful spoilers and proceeded to trash the capital, Dili. The referendum led on to independence for the new nation of Timor-Leste. At the time, our role generated hostility towards Australia amongst national elements in Indonesia. And that's what concerned Dick, but I think that hostility was totally wrong and badly based. Since then, there's been great progress and a resumption of the substantial achievements in relations initiated by Evans. It was temporarily arrested, but quickly redressed. A conspicuous area of bilateral cooperation has been the strengthening of relations with the United States. Need any say any more with now the fourth in a row of US presidents just landed in Australia. Another has been the development of Australia's agency. And another is our relationship with Britain. I was part of Australia's negotiating team when Britain was seeking to join the EEC. It took quite a while for Australian leaders to realise that Britain was not going to protect Australian interests. Indeed, that Britain's interests were very different from ours, and that we had to fight hard on our own. Leaders like Doug Anthony realised we had to develop new markets elsewhere to replace what we're losing because of rampant protectionism in Europe. Britain joining the EEC did us a favour. It accentuated a focus on Asia, obliged us to look more closely at markets in the Middle East and Latin America, and encouraged us to think more broadly about Europe. Just reflecting on the foreign ministers since that early time, or since the early 1950s, the most significant foreign ministers, in my view, in the past 60 years have been Percy Spender and Gareth Evans. Spender's achievements on Australia's behalf in negotiating the ANZUS Treaty and in inaugurating the Colombo Plan of assistance to Asia and Pacific countries were outstanding. Evans' achievement in transforming Australia's fragile relationship with our largest neighbour, Indonesia, was of the highest order. Keating, Howard, Downer and Rudd subsequently made important contributions, but it was Evans who added the substance and ballast that made later achievements possible. Evans raised the bar, and others have built on the raised bar that Evans raised. And for his substantial and innovative work in bringing peace to Cambodia, Evans was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. The story of our foreign and trade policy is not all positive. Australia's success in building political and commercial links with Asia has not been matched by a commensurate success in building up a generation of Asia-literate Australians comfortable with the languages and cultures of our region. At our universities, as is well known, enrolments in Asian languages are very low. In Indonesian and Japanese, they've been declining. And those studying Mandarin are mainly students of Chinese origin, and many of them are Cantonese-speaking Chinese seeking to learn Mandarin. In the 1960s, 40% of high school students studied a second language for matriculation. Today, the number is 12% and declining. Australia's first Prime Minister, Edmund Barton, carried on a conversation with the Pope in Latin. For 100 years, until Rudd, no Australian Prime Minister, no Foreign Minister, no Trade or Defence Minister was able to converse officially in a foreign language. What a contrast with Indonesia, where the street sweeper in Jakarta speaks two languages, Betawi and Bahasa Indonesia. The elite in Indonesia happily speak three or four languages and don't think there's anything special. Australia's expenditure on two-way cultural exchanges with Asia is derisory and a national embarrassment. Understanding Asian cultures and values is crucial if we're to engage successfully in the region in the long term. And surprisingly, two former diplomats, Downer and Rudd, allowed the resources of the Foreign Service to be run down. Poor leadership on Asian languages and culture are some of the greatest failures of our political leaders over the past two decades. There have been other failures. We've accepted 700,000 refugees over the past 70 years. That's roughly 10,000 a year. And the overwhelming majority have become good citizens. But now both sides of politics have lost a sense of perspective. The number of refugees fleeing to Europe are in the hundreds of thousands, while the United States has over 12 million illegal migrants. The tawdry national debate now going on about refugees diminishes us as a nation. Even worse, some among us are becoming fearful. A confident society is imperiled by fear. Fear will erode the confidence we must have to prosper and play our part in the community of nations. My generation of diplomats believed, and still believes, that a larger population is in Australia's interests. But support for this is waning. We risk letting the failures of state governments on infrastructure, the failures of state government on water, define and limit our national ambitions. We risk losing the notion of the future as a positive place to be. In the book, and I mention this because Dick Wilcott's mentioned it in his remarks, I've not given a comprehensive attention to the war in Iraq because this conflict arose after I left the service. But I became involved in the issue of intelligence about the war when I was asked by government to conduct a review of our intelligence agencies. My inquiry concluded emphatically that there was an intelligence failure. Indeed, we shared in the Allied intelligence failure on the key question of stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. There's been much revisionist writing to the effect that Allied leaders lied about the presence of weapons of mass destruction. This is not correct. Prior to military action against Iraq in March 2003, all major governments, not just the Western Allies participating in the war, all the governments, including France, Germany, China, Japan and Russia, all of those governments believed that Saddam had WMD. The only government in the world that claimed Iraq was not working on and did not have biological and chemical weapons was the government of Saddam Hussein. The fact that Saddam Hussein chose to resist inspections to the bitter end suggested strongly, though in the event wrongly, that he had WMD to protect and perhaps that he hoped to avoid defeat by using them. Many people now choose to ignore the other factors relevant to the Iraq conflict, and these were Saddam's egregious breaches of UN Security Council resolutions, his history of the use of WMD, the brutal nature of his regime, and his support for terrorism, all of which combine to form a potent threat to the international community. I'm one of the minority, seems to be a dwindling minority, who thought the decision to invade Iraq was correct. I still believe that. The decision was justified, but it was not well handled. The most glaring weakness by the United States was the failure to prepare adequately for the aftermath of the war and America's desultory cultural knowledge of Iraq. It seems that America hadn't learned the lessons from Vietnam. But even now, 70% of Iraqis, 70% of Iraqis feel it was worthwhile getting rid of Saddam. His rule had benefited mainly the 20% who were Sunnis at the expense of the Shias and the Kurds. It may be 20 years before we know the full outcome of the Iraq war. Now, of course, the world's a scary place. It's a global economic crisis, poor economic and financial management in many places, an insane regime in North Korea, foolish pretensions in Iraq, fragile governance in Pakistan, deep-seated tensions in the Middle East, an unresolved crisis in Palestine, deluded Islamist terrorists, insufficient controls on nuclear weapons, infectious diseases that can be transmitted with terrifying swiftness because of the speed and frequency of modern travel, and much else. And it's easy to be pessimistic. My book argues there are good reasons for Australians to be optimistic about our future. We've embraced the benefits of globalisation and we're well linked to the fastest growing countries in Asia. We're the only Western country positioned so geographically close to Asia. Our federal political and legal institutions are impressively strong, and our economic and financial institutions have proved to be more robust than those of larger competitors. And we're well placed in terms of our resources to tackle the social problems that our community faces. But I'm not starry-eyed and have no illusions. Many of you will have seen the current production of Julius Caesar by the Bell Shakespeare Company at the Opera House. The ambition of Caesar, the weakness of Brutus, and the duplicity and treachery of Cassius were well on display. Very little has changed. We see daily in our politics ruthlessness, intrigue, incompetence, flattery, and self-delusion. We should never be surprised that the great vital forces of the human soul, love, self-sacrifice, heroism, and artistic creativity, are more in evidence in the community and in our own families than in the national parliament. Nevertheless, our political leaders are very, very important, for they have the greatest influence in changing society. And whatever you think of our federal politicians, nationally, we are not governed by corrupt elites seeking personal wealth. The high standards of legality, transparency and accountability enforced at the federal level are a redoubtable bulwark against financial misdemeanour on the part of elected federal politicians. Much more importantly, Australia's constitution, the High Court, a professional civil service, a robust media and regular elections, though not a guarantee, make it hard to sustain poor policies, or at least hard to sustain poor policies for very long. Even during a financial crisis, we have a good reason to be optimistic. Thanks.
Many thanks, Philip Flood, and we've got some copies of Dancing with Warriors, a diplomatic memoir outside. It's a nice hardback and at a good price with some very interesting illustrations. So we come to question and discussion. The comments that I read on behalf of Dick Walcock were brief, and Philip Flood has also been brief, so we have plenty of time. So in your speech, you referred to the coalition's Percy Spender and Labour's Gareth Evans as the two most impressive foreign ministers. That takes us back to 1950, that takes us back 60 years, and you've worked with all the prime ministers from Gough Whitlam on. Would you care to reflect on who you believe are the Australia's best prime ministers in your time or before that?
There's no ambiguity about my view on this. I think the best prime ministers have been Hawke and Howard. In that time, I think the decisions that those two governments have taken were remarkable and have stood us in remarkably good stead, especially those whole collection of economic decisions that you know as well as I do, the collection of decisions that were taken by the Hawke government and then the decisions that were taken by the Howard government. For those 24 years from 83 to 2007, they have been remarkable, and I think in the period that I've known government, they have been the two best governments that we've had.
So, let's have a look. There's a question down there, then we come over here, then we come over there. Yeah, down there? Yeah. You just stay here and talk to the back. Yeah.
The Prime Minister's decision to recommend the Labour caucus to take his change of stance on the selling of the uranium to India, would you like to comment on that? Will that be a breakthrough in terms of Australian relationship with India?
Just because this has been recorded, I'll just briefly repeat the questions about Australia's decision of Julie Gillard to change Labour Party policy on export of uranium to India.
As I understand it, the decision by Julie Gillard to recommend a change of policy to the Labour Party conference is not yet a change of policy by the Labour Party or by the government. But I hope very much it becomes a change of policy. I think this is a belated decision and a very sensible one. I think it was wrong of Rudd in 2008 to change the policy. It was extraordinary of Australia in 2008 to decide that as a member of the nuclear suppliers group, that it was all right to export uranium to India, but it wasn't all right for Australia to export uranium to India. That was an extraordinary decision. It was a hypocritical decision in 2008 to decline to export uranium to India, and I think the sooner that policy is reversed, the better. There's truth in what Rudd says, that India doesn't need our uranium at the moment. It's able to get uranium from other sources, but it's going to need our uranium in the future. We're a major supplier, depending on how you want to measure it, low-grade, high-grade uranium is at 30% or 40%. We have a major share of the world's supplies. At the moment, India derives 13% of its power from nuclear power, but its plans are to get 25%. There's no doubt that in the future, India is going to need much more uranium. And India has shown itself to be a responsible member of the international community. Unlike North Korea, unlike Iran, India hasn't indulged in willful proliferation of nuclear technology or much less nuclear weapons, and I think we should trust India on its record, and so I hope that the Prime Minister Gillard's colleagues see the merit of what she's proposing.
Okay, so there's a question there, let me come up here. Yep. No, you can stand up.
My voice isn't very loud. I look forward to reading your book, but I worry that you're going to tell us that the diplomatic service has gone to pot since your time.
No, the diplomatic service hasn't gone to pot. It's just been reduced in scale, and I think that's regrettable. We have a very small number of missions compared with the average of the countries of the OECD, which have 150 missions. We have 90 missions, and we need to have many more missions than we have. I think it's very regrettable that we haven't opened new missions in the west of China. China's an extremely large country, and we're not as well informed as we ought to be. So I think we've had two foreign ministers probably overconfident about their own abilities. They were happy to use the resources of foreign affairs, but they've neglected to maintain the store of expertise. The Foreign Service or the Department of Foreign Affairs hasn't gone to pot, but it's suffered significant reductions, and that needs to be redressed. Now, I know that Foreign Minister Rudd is starting to do that, but quite a bit of damage was done under his prime ministership in the first 2.5 years. I think he's now realised that that was a mistake, and he's seeking to redress the situation. But the sooner it's done, the better.
Question here.
Philip Stefan Wisniewski, thank you for coming today. My name is launching the book, it's very exciting. My question was really quite current about Barack Obama being here and announcing U.S. forces being stationed in Australia on a permanent rotating basis and so on. Well, could you make an observation on our tact and our ability on balancing our relationship with the U.S. and at the same time with China, which are both obviously critical countries to us for different reasons?
Look, like you, I'm fascinated in what President Obama says in his speech tonight and his speech tomorrow in the Parliament and his... presumably his statement in Darwin when he goes there tomorrow. I'd be surprised if he announces that he's setting up a new base in Australia or that he's stationing American forces here. Comments by the government have suggested that that's not the case. So I don't know precisely what's planned, whether there are plans for more ship visits or whether there are plans to store equipment in Darwin. I'm not privy to those matters, and we'll learn in the next 24 hours what he has in mind. On the question of relations between us and the United States and us and China, I believe that we're skillful enough to manage the situation of being friends of China and an ally of the United States. And I'm hopeful that that won't be cause us difficulties in the future. It's going to be potentially a tricky situation, but I'm hopeful that we won't have major difficulties in that respect. A lot depends on how the United States handles this situation. Americans are currently confronting a very difficult situation. America's confronted challenges in the 1950s and 60s from the then Soviet Union. America confronted challenges in the 1980s from Japan. The challenge now is of a very different order. This is a country that's now going to be as large economically as the United States. Depending on who's your source of information, some people think that China's economy now, in purchasing parity terms, is the equal of the United States. The IMF thinks China will be the equal of the United States by 2016. Others think it'll be sometime in the 2020s. But it's just inexorable that the Chinese economy becomes larger than the economy of the United States. But having said that, I think it'll be a long time before China has the military weight, the military strength of the United States. I was at a conference in Princeton in the United States about 3 years ago looking at some of these issues, and at that time the global military expenditure was of the order of $1.2 trillion. The United States expenditure was half that total, and China's expenditure was much less than a tenth of that total, much less. China is catching up, but I think it'll be a long time before China has the military weight to match the United States. Some people are getting concerned because China's buying one aircraft carrier. For heaven's sake, one aircraft carrier, really. So there's a long way to go. I hope the Americans are responsible in managing their relationship with China. They're going to have to accept a greater role for China. Unquestionably, with this economic strength comes a desire on China to play a greater political role. It's already apparent in things like quotas for the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, but China's going to want more space politically, and America's going to have to accept a role for China that's very different to what has transpired. America can no longer aspire to be the totally dominant power in the Asia-Pacific region. And it's true now, America can't determine the global agenda now. It was possible 20 years ago, but the United States now enjoys less relative power. I hope, like Henry Kissinger, that the United States manages this transition and this change in global balance of power that has a peaceful evolution, but clearly it's something that has to be watched very, very closely.
Now we've got plenty of time, so we've got to be quick over here. Yeah.
Yes. In that most communist countries seem to get fed up with communism after a certain period of time, wasn't a waste of our men going into Vietnam, our intervention in Vietnam?
It's a question about the Vietnam War, which is a bit before your time, isn't it?
Yeah, Look, I'm unrepentant on that issue. It was not a waste of time going into Vietnam. I don't believe it was. But look, that's a much larger issue that goes beyond the issues that I think we're debating now.
Michael.
Philip, you were my boss when I was in New York in 96 when Australia's bid to join the Security Council was defeated. It was the Agatha Christie issue. The butler did it. I'm wondering if you could give us an indication of whether attempting to join the Security Council prejudices our international relationships because of the need to appeal to a host of countries whose interests needn't necessarily be ours, apart from, of course, the expense involved. And what do you think of the current bid's prospects of success?
Well, the answer to the first question is that unquestionably, being a member of the Security Council obliges any country to take a position on a range of matters that are outside their normal foreign policy interests. But I don't worry about that. I think we have to see ourselves as a significant medium-sized country. We're the 12th, depending on which year you measure it, 12th largest economy in the world. I think it's a reasonable aspiration for Australia to want to be a member of the Security Council. There are 5 permanent members and there are 10 other members. So from time to time, being one of the 10, I think it's a reasonable aspiration for a country of our size.
I was concerned more about buying votes.
But
it's
very expensive. And what worries me about the current bid is that not enough funds have been allocated to it, and that the funds for the Security Council campaign are taking other funds away from the Foreign Service, so that we're damaging the Foreign Service by the expenditure on the Security Council. So I'm disappointed that it's not a better funded campaign. But I don't have a problem in principle with the campaign. I just wonder if it's being well managed at the present time. There are serious problems for us. One of the competitors is Luxembourg, that has automatically 27 votes as a member of the EU. For heaven's sake, Luxembourg, as a member of the Security Council. I mean, it's borderline joke. But they do have a lot of votes. We don't have a natural constituency. We should be able to count and can normally count on the support of New Zealand. We should be able to count on support of some of the Pacific Islands, but sometimes that's problematic. We have to work hard to build up a constituency of votes. To get 27 votes is a major task for Australia. Really is a major task. Luxembourg starts with 27 before they campaign with other countries. So it's a problematical exercise, and it should only be attempted with substantial resources. It's very expensive. But it's not an unreasonable aspiration for a country of our size.
And as you know, Canada missed out recently, didn't it?
Yes.
So what was Canada's
problem? We missed out in, as yeah. Michael knows, in the 1990s, we were defeated by Portugal. And, for heaven's sake, Portugal, really. I'm probably in danger of causing diplomatic incidents, but really... But it was, and there were problems, and Michael has pinpointed a serious problem that took place last time. His humorous remarks are absolutely correct. There were problems.
I think I probably should explain. His humorous remarks, it was the butler that done it, is a reference to Richard Butler, who was the Australian ambassador to the United Nations at the time. You don't have to say any more, but I think I should fill in for
those. No, it's much more complicated than that. It wasn't just that, but the government did not have accurate information from the permanent representative in New York about the chances of winning the bid and who was on our side and who was not on our side. But the problems go well beyond the permanent representative. We were misled about our support in Africa and that was the responsibility of other parties.
Right. Richard, we've got plenty of time. We've got to... So
could you give us your views on what you think the medium term, by that I mean 5 more years, is for Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Look, I'd have to acknowledge humbly that I am not an expert on Afghanistan. I'm not an expert in Pakistan. I worry about that conflict. I worry about the fact that it's extended far too long. There are alliance reasons why we are there. There are alliance reasons for staying the distance. But it does seem to be an intractable situation. There's a lot of misunderstanding about what our objectives are. Objectives were never to bring peace to Afghanistan. Our objectives were never to bring good governance to Afghanistan. Objectives were never to set up a reliable government there. Objectives were much less, but there seems to be enormous confusion in the public mind, about what our objectives were. My understanding is that our objective has been to make sure that Afghanistan is not an effective base for terrorism that can damage Western interests, and that Al-Qaeda was nullified within Afghanistan. It was not our objective to prevent the Taliban coming into government. It was never our objective to ensure that women should have proper rights in Afghanistan. Of course we'd like to see that, but that wasn't our objective. The objectives were much more limited, but it has gone on a long time, and I just believe we're easing ourselves into a situation where we're withdrawing from Afghanistan. But it is regrettable that it's gone on so long.
Now, we have not much time, so there's a question there, then we go down the back, and then we come up here. Yeah. Don't need to stand up, there's a camera here. Yeah.
Should Australia be paying more attention to Antarctica and southern oceans, since other countries seem to be directing their attention increasingly, including China?
Look, I think we've always maintained a consistent interest in Antarctica. We claim slightly more than 40% of Antarctica. We claim a territory in Antarctica that's greater than our continental area. But our claim is not recognised. It's recognised by certain other claimants, but it's not recognised by the international community. And in 1961, we agreed to the Antarctic Treaty that froze all claims, so no claims are recognised. I think we have a good record in what we've done in Antarctica. I think both governments have taken sensible initiatives about having Antarctica as a peaceful area, having Antarctica not despoiled the environment, not a site of competing mineral exploration. So I'm not sure what new initiatives we could take. I think both sides of politics have been responsible about Antarctica, and it will never, unless it becomes a competing area, unless it is in some way used militarily, which seems difficult to foresee, I don't think ever Antarctica is likely to become one of the frontline foreign policy issues confronting Australia.
Right down the back, got to be quick. Yep.
Are you able to express any view about the intermediate future for Myanmar and the expenditure that's being apparently devoted to development of new capital and new military facilities in the country?
Question about the future of Myanmar.
Look, again, I have to say I'm not an expert on Myanmar. I welcome the efforts that both sides of politics have made to try to improve the situation, the support that we've given to Aung San Suu Kyi, the support we've given through a modest aid program, helping elements in Myanmar. One would like to see the ASEAN countries more robust in standing up to Myanmar. There's been a certain willingness to be defensive about Myanmar, and I think that's regrettable. But you have to feel sympathy for the people of Myanmar who've had to endure the most appalling form of government in recent decades.
Okay, there's a question up here, and then we go to Anthea.
Are there lessons to be learned from what's happening now in Europe with the European Union and the euro for any new regional framework along the lines of what Rudd has proposed, perhaps to take over from APEC in the future?
Look, the short answer to that is manage our economy the way it was managed from 83 to 2007, and don't manage our economies the way the Europeans have been managing their economies. That's the most important lesson from what's been happening in Europe. It's an extraordinary situation, but the Europeans are paying a price for the fiscal profligacy of recent decades and a model of social welfare that we haven't embraced here. And I hope we never seek to embrace that kind of model of social welfare that the Europeans have tried. It's very clear that it's not working.
I'll take you back to the public service, Canberra and all of that. We've heard the Jill Kern-Conway story about her wanting to be in the Foreign Affairs Department and missing out because she wasn't highly, awarded enough in the final year. I heard from a young woman in Canberra the other day that Foreign Affairs doesn't take the top young graduates as much as they used to, and a young woman who's a brilliant scholar wasn't even considered when she applied recently, and that we've moved to a point where Foreign Affairs is looking more to people who've had life experience and longer time away from university. So looking back on your career and what it was like going in when you were a young graduate, what do you think is the best way to improve the Foreign Service if you think it's been, you know, starved a bit in the recent past? And with our language studies dropping, what is the way forward? Is it best to encourage more of our brightest younger people back in?
Look, I'm not sure that your premises are accurate about what's the current policy of the Department of Foreign Affairs. I just don't know. But I'd be very surprised if it's as you described it. And just as an aside, on the question of Jill Kerr Conway, I think that was extraordinarily regrettable that Jill was denied admission to the department. As she's written in her book, The Road from Corain, she was told that A, she was too beautiful, B, she was too assertive, and C, she'd be married in no time at all. Now, I think that's an extraordinary example of discrimination, and that no longer applies, and it hasn't applied for a long time. The Foreign Service is a great career, and I would encourage the best and the brightest young graduates to contemplate Foreign Service. But it does need a special interest in foreign cultures. It needs a willingness to understand foreign cultures. It needs a willingness to be prepared to travel for long periods away from Australia, to live away from Australia. It needs special requirements. It's not something that everybody can do. The Foreign Service poses special demands on people's families, and I think now, for some time, for 20 years, where both partners want to work, the Foreign Service has had to adapt to that situation. So for 20 years, the Foreign Service has been managing the issue of both parties wanting to work. It's much more complicated to manage a Foreign Service now, but how can I say other than it's a great career and it offers wonderful psychic rewards? But you won't get the rewards of being a merchant banker in this town if you join the Foreign Service.
Just a final question. I mean, there's a huge amount of information, obviously a lot of research in this book. So how did you go about writing the book, which you've just released? What was your process? Why did you do it? How did you do it?
The answer to how I did it, I wrote it at home over a period of 18 months. I have, probably like everybody in this room, a substantial, significant library of books about foreign policy, about Australian foreign policy. So I wrote at home essentially from memory and from notebooks that I had kept. But when I completed my service with the department, I gave, as one does, Commonwealth Archives the records that I'd kept personally. And I'd been a squirrel over the years, and I'd kept nearly 20 to 30 metres of boxes of records. I was fortunate to be able to keep a large number of records there in the Commonwealth Archives. So when I had written a draft myself at home, I then went and spent 3 months in Commonwealth Archives. I found in the next room was John Howard doing his work, checking the archives. So, and I found that a very salutary experience, checking the record, because memories play tricks with one. Barry Jones has read the whole book. Barry Jones has read every footnote. Barry Jones has read every endnote, and he's read every index. And he says, I've made one mistake. I've made a mistake about Inspector Maigret when I'm describing the situation in Belgium. He accepts that Hercule Poirot is a Belgian, but he doesn't accept that Inspector Maigret, he's adamant, and I think he's right. Maigret's a Frenchman. But so I wrote it at home, and then I checked the records in the archives. Why did I do it? Well, I think I had a story to tell. I had some wonderful postings. I had some wonderful experiences. And I was privileged to work for some remarkable prime ministers. So I think it was a story worth telling. I hope it's seen by others as a contribution to history, a contribution to the history of foreign affairs. Rawdon Dalrymple is sitting quietly down there. He's done the same thing. He's written a large book, and other colleagues have written books as a contribution to history. Some people will like it, some people won't like it. So I got a lot of pleasure out of writing it. So I think to write a book is an indulgence, unquestionably. So there's an element of personal indulgence in writing any book, and I don't shy away from admitting that.
Many thanks. Take a seat. Philip Flood spoke for the Sydney Institute when he was a serving officer in the Department of Foreign Affairs, and he was diplomatic and cautious, interesting, but there are limitations on what you can say when you're a public servant, even a senior public servant. But he's come back today having written a very important book, which is extremely well researched. It's a great reference book, but also a great read, Dancing with Warriors, and I said Anne's got some copies of it outside. So I just say, I'm very pleased that Philip Flood has written this book. The more senior Australians who write about their experience in senior positions, the better. John Howard, Show and the Way, with his book on politics. Philip Flood, a book on the Foreign Affairs Department. So well done, and good luck with the books.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.